You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease Is Your Podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, Dr. Kara Brown joined us to talk about equine soft tissue injuries and rehabilitation. This episode of Disease Du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Brown is an assistant professor of equine sports medicine and rehabilitation at Penn Vet's New Bolton Center. She is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. After graduation, she completed an equine internship at Woodside Equine Clinic, followed by a large animal internship, a clinical fellowship in large animal cardiology and ultrasound, and a residency training program in equine sports medicine and rehabilitation at New Bolton Center. She is a boarded diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Sports Medicine and Rehabilitation, and has a strong clinical and research interest in poor performance in the equine athlete, axial skeletal pain, and regenerative medicine. Thank you, Dr. Brown, for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Of course. To get us started, can you briefly walk us through the pathophysiology of tendon and ligament injuries?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, outside of actual trauma like lacerations, tendon and ligament injuries usually are just due to overstrain. And that's either going to be as a single overload event, which is really probably the minority of situations. So, you know, maybe taking, you know, an abnormal step. More likely, this is going to just be due to chronic repetitive strain. And that really starts with degeneration. And that's going to result in inflammation. And during this time, during that those kind of early phases, the horse actually might not be lame or may just be very subtly lame and may just start with some performance issues. That inflammation weakens the tendon over time. And then with continued exercise and strain on the tendon, the structural properties of the tendon are overwhelmed. And then that's actually going to result in that damage to the fiber. Unfortunately, because tendon and ligament repair actually repairs with a large amount of scar tissue, which is strong but not really elastic, horses are then, once that repair tissue gets put down, very prone to re-injury in these healed areas, just again, due to that kind of altered functional characteristic of the repaired tendon.
Right. I know this makes it a little bit complicated to manage sometimes.
Absolutely.
What are some of the more common injuries that veterinarians are likely to see in practice?
Yeah, it definitely depends on what type of horse and what discipline you're dealing with. But really across the board, the soft tissues on the palmar or the back aspect of the cannon bone and the plantar aspect of the cannon bone are most prone to injury. So those kind of flexor tendons and ligaments. So those are really going to include the superficial and deep digital flexor tendons, the suspensory ligament, and the check ligament or the inferior check ligament.
Okay. Is that just related to how horses naturally move or some of the workload that they're more likely to have?
Yeah, absolutely. Those structures just withstand probably the highest loads of all of the structures within the lower limb or the distal limb because of all of the work that they do kind of keeping the fetlock suspended. So that's probably why. Interestingly, horses kind of evolved to have a lot of musculature in the proximal aspect of the limb. And so that's, you know, for a couple of reasons, partially just because it makes the limb a lot lighter. So as prey animals, they're trying to have light limbs so that they can run quickly. And also those long tendons and ligaments hold a lot of energy in them. And so they kind of almost act like springs. So there's a lot of kind of passive movement involved in running, which evolutionarily makes them very, very targeted as prey animals. But it doesn't actually help them out from a tendon and ligament perspective because they're also very prone to injury.
Right. Are there certain horses that are more predisposed to soft tissue injuries, maybe based on their breed or their discipline or age or conformation or any comorbidities?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of risk factors in terms of soft tissue injuries. So one of them is just speed. So the speed at which the horse trains under or competes under. Speed is going to increase strain and load, and also just the number of loading cycles. And just as an example, the superficial digital flexor tendon experiences like 1,500 to 2,200 pounds of load at the gallop. So you can imagine galloping for long periods of time or repetitively can really increase the risk of injury to those structures. Age is another one. Like everything, it kind of increases risk of injury, but age is going to decrease extracellular matrix components, so structural components of the soft tissues. It decreases something called crimp. So crimp is kind of the zigzag pattern of the tendon and ligament fibrils. They kind of act as a spring and a protection for overstrain that tends to straighten over time. And so that is also going to put those horses at increased risk. And then you talked about comorbidities. One of the things that we see with relative frequency in horses that are older are metabolic diseases like Cushing's disease. Cushing's disease, we know based on literature, can increase the risk of suspensory ligament desmitis or injury. And actually, horses with Cushing's disease can have histologic changes within their suspensory ligaments that look very like horses with degenerative suspensory ligament disease. So that can definitely increase the risk of injury in that region. Conformation, you mentioned that as well. That can definitely alter the amount of strain that tendons and ligaments experience. So a good example of that I see in practice with some relative frequency is that like long toe, low heel conformation in horses that can increase strain on those palmar structures, particularly within the foot, the deep digital flexor tendon. And so I tend to see damage to that tendon in horses with that type of conformation. You mentioned discipline. I think there's definitely some horses, I should say, these structures can all be injured in all kinds of horses, right? And horses don't always read the book in terms of which structures should and shouldn't be injured with their discipline. But we definitely see some that tend to be more and less associated with certain disciplines. So those kind of classic bowed tendons, kind of mid-metacarpal, superficial digital flexor tendonitis tend to be in those horses that are going at high speed. So thoroughbred race horses, eventing horses, things like that. Suspensory desmitis we see in a lot of horses, but definitely Western performance horses, dressage horses, you know, hunter jumpers, some of those English sports. Particularly proximal suspensory desmitis in all of those sports can happen elsewhere, like in the branches, but we see those very particularly in those kinds of disciplines. And then deep digital flexor tendonitis, we see that as a part of kind of that navicular disease syndrome in Western performance horses, especially quarter horses that tend to be predisposed to navicular disease. But it can definitely be present without navicular disease. I see this with relative frequency in English performance horses, again, particularly hunters and jumpers, and that can be present within the digital sheath in those horses as well.
Interesting. If a veterinarian has a client or a patient that has some of these risk factors, are there any preventative strategies that they can recommend to the owner?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, just knowing where the injury lies or where the injury could lie can really help early detection of those injuries and also targeted diagnostics. So if you have a sense that horse may be more predisposed to a proximal suspensory injury, for instance, in a horse with poor performance, that may be an area that you focus on, either in terms of, you know, making sure to block that area or assess that area from an imaging perspective. You know, in terms of prevention, it can definitely, it's something that's difficult because it's hard to train the tendon and ligament. You can't train it like you can the cardiovascular system in preparation for things, but there are certainly things that you can do to try to minimize the risk. That can be things like, you know, limiting excessive repetitive movements, limiting overloading exercises. So doing those exercises that you need to train the horse for what it does, but trying to limit those types of exercises, specifically, you know, high speed over fences work. And, you know, really just making sure to manage those other risk factors. So, you know, conformational issues, making sure to know if your horse has a low heel conformation, you know, in those cases, keeping an eye on the solar angle for a horse with a, you know, predisposition to a deep digital flexor tendon tear, making sure you know if those older horses have any underlying metabolic issues like Cushing's disease. And I think, you know, in general, keeping those horses that are particularly predisposed at appropriate weights can be really helpful as well, so that we're managing or at least decreasing the tendency for overloading those tendons.
Yeah, that's a great point. This podcast is brought to you by Equithrive. Breeding places a unique and time-sensitive demand on the mare's body. Following breeding, a healthy uterine immune response and timely return to balance are essential for creating an optimal environment for conception and early pregnancy. University studies show that Equithrive mare pellets support post-breeding uterine immune balance and inflammatory resolution during the most critical stages of the breeding cycle. Do you have a problem mare? Learn more about the science behind Equithrive mare pellets by clicking the link in the description or visiting equithrive.com. So when you are evaluating a horse with a suspected soft tissue injury, what are some of the subtle and more obvious clinical signs that you would be looking for?
Yeah, so the obvious clinical signs of a tendon and ligament injury are going to be things like swelling or enlargement of the tendon or around the tendon. Depending on the location, if the tendon lives within a synovial sheath, then you might see effusion of the sheath itself. So things like the digital flexor tendon sheath or the carpal sheath, heat in that area. Pain on palpation can be helpful, and it can be helpful particularly if the horse has unilateral pain. You do have to be a little bit careful in terms of your interpretation because sensitivity to palpation doesn't always indicate injury. Some horses just happen to be a bit more sensitive than others. So definitely interpret that, you know, with a grain of salt. And then lameness is definitely the other obvious, you know, sign of injury. And it's important to note that horses display lameness during tendon and ligament injury kind of differently depending on the degree of injury, but also where they're injured. So for instance, horses with deep digital flexor tendonitis, especially adjacent to the navicular bone, tend to be really painful despite sometimes having subtle tears in those areas. Whereas I've definitely had horses with more prominent, you know, superficial digital flexor tendon lesions or inferior check ligament lesions that can actually be pretty comfortable despite more obvious injuries, especially when the kind of acute inflammatory phase of that injury has resolved. So lameness, absolutely important, but it doesn't always correlate very well with the actual degree of injury.
Yeah, I can be frustrating when those clinical signs don't match the severity of the injury. Sometimes it can make it a little bit challenging.
It can make it really challenging. And there are subtle signs too. You know, in those early phases, the horse may not be overtly lame, which makes it really challenging, or maybe so subtly lame that it's difficult to detect really with the human eye. So that's where things like relying on your owners to have early indicators of poor performance and making sure that once they start to see those signs of poor performance, especially in a horse that's maybe predisposed to tendon or ligament injury, that they're having you take a look at that horse. They may just report things like lack of impulsion or inability to perform certain movements. Stopping at fences, for instance, might be something. So, and of course, there's a lot of overlapping clinical signs with those things, you know, and other causes of musculoskeletal disease and even non-musculoskeletal disease. But it's something to keep in mind, particularly for those horses that are at particular risk for tendon ligament injury.
Right. What does your diagnostic process typically look like as you start to narrow down the cause of some of these issues? And which imaging modalities do you typically reach for, especially if you're a practitioner in the field and maybe you don't have, you know, the whole range of options that you would have in a hospital setting?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, physical examination, first and foremost, I think, you know, all the things that we talked about before, pain on palpation and enlargement of the ligament or tendon. And I think that the way I typically describe this is that step number one is really localizing the lameness or confirming that the lameness is in the location that you think it is. And so localization can be helpful from a physical exam perspective, but from a gait evaluation perspective, I often rely on diagnostic analgesia or blocking to confirm that pain is coming from the area that I think it may be. The reason that that's really important is that some horses with previously bowed tendons or other kind of tendon and ligament pathology will often have enlargement of that soft tissue structure without it necessarily being the current source of pain, and it can be really misleading. So the first step for me is really, if possible, confirming that that location is the source of pain. And that, you know, combined with my physical exam, that's really where I think the pain is coming from. You know, if the horse isn't lame, which does happen, if it can't be blocked, which can happen for a variety of reasons, maybe the owner isn't interested in you blocking, or, you know, the horse isn't safe to block, that certainly happens. If there are clear signs of injury, you know, swelling, heat, effusion, then you can treat that as your localization. And or if this horse has, again, a particular predisposing discipline or conformation that leads you to be concerned about a certain area, you can certainly treat that as your localization as well. But really, gold standard is going to be blocking, response to blocking. So that's number one in terms of my diagnostic process. And then number two is, what in this area is causing pain? And that's really what the imaging is for. From a field perspective, ultrasound is definitely going to be kind of the bread and butter for identifying soft tissue injuries. It's the least expensive diagnostic modality for, and certainly most portable from a soft tissue perspective. You know, obviously you can do it without general anesthesia. And what you're looking for are things like enlargement of the cross-sectional area of the tendon or the ligament, abnormal fiber patterns, disruptions in fiber patterns, so hypoechoic or anechoic or black lesions within that ligament or tendon. There are certainly some limitations to ultrasound, so it has to be in an area that's accessible to ultrasound. The one area that I think across the board is very difficult to assess is the most distal portion of the deep digital flexor tendon within the foot. It is very challenging to assess via ultrasound. You can get a pretty good look at it just above the navicular bone, but otherwise it can be pretty challenging. And at the same time, ultrasound sometimes is difficult to use to assess ligaments with certain characteristics. So the best example in my book is probably the suspensory ligament, the upper portion of the suspensory ligament or the proximal suspensory ligament. It has muscle and fiber bundles within it, which makes it already pretty heterogeneous in its characteristics, which then makes that really difficult to distinguish from an actual lesion. This is definitely something that gets better with experience, or it may be easier with experience, but truly, there are some things that we just cannot detect without more advanced imaging modalities. And if it's not present on, you know, ultrasound in the field, then there's a number of different diagnostic imaging modalities that we can rely on to try to get more information. MRI is probably the one that we use the most, or, you know, kind of across the board is being used the most for evaluating soft tissue injuries. Definitely more expensive, you know, obviously performed at a referral hospital, can be done under general anesthesia or standing, really depending on the location. And you do just have to be aware that there is some motion artifact present as you kind of go higher and higher in the limb in the standing MRIs. But we get pretty good diagnostic images now with the standing MRIs. And probably the most important way in which we use MRIs to assess those areas that we can't even see on ultrasound. So within the hoof wall, the soft tissue structures within the hoof wall, it is very, very good at. And it's much more sensitive for subtle injuries, and it can help you identify or differentiate, I guess I would say, between chronic and active injuries. It's also really helpful for things like the upper portion of the suspensory ligament, where that ultrasound can be difficult to rely on. And actually, there's a newer one kind of called PET or positron emission tomography. This is kind of a fun one. It's a type of nuclear imaging that's similar to bone scan, but it has better spatial resolution. So you get a lot more detail, and you can get actually a cross-sectional image of the nuclear imaging, and then fuse it with something like an MRI or computed tomography or a CT. And it uses specific radio tracers that are really good for soft tissue called FDG. And like MRI, it's really good at locating areas of active injury, but it is typically used in combination with a cross-sectional imaging modality. So sometimes we'll use it to kind of screen the lower limb to say, hey, I think there's active injury in this area, and then we'll follow up with an MRI. Or if we have a question about an MRI and are looking to get another indicator of active injury, then we'll employ the PET scan as well. That's definitely something that's newer, but it's, I think, becoming really helpful for us in those really difficult to identify, more subtle cases.
Yeah, and that's becoming more widely available, I believe, right?
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a standing. What's great about it is that it's standing. And so it's not something that has to be done under general anesthesia. And you're absolutely right. We have one here at New Bolton Center, but it is becoming much more widely available now, both for bone and for soft tissue.
If a soft tissue injury is detectable in ultrasound, is there still merit to sending them to more advanced diagnostics in some cases, or can you proceed pretty confidently with management from that point?
Yeah, it depends a lot on what structure you're talking about. So for instance, for, you know, your kind of average clear core lesion in the superficial digital flexor tendon in the mid metacarpal or kind of mid cannon bone region, I would say for the most part, those are treated, you know, you can proceed confidently with treatment of those areas. That said, sometimes we have more questions than what we can answer on ultrasound. So I keep going back to this, but an example would be, if you can identify a lesion in the deep digital flexor tendon very clearly in the mid-pastern, in some ways that can increase the risk of an injury further down in the foot. And so sometimes we'll have questions like, you know, we can see something in this location, but is there something additionally in a location that we can't see on ultrasound? Or we'll see changes on the ultrasound that are clearly indicative of injury, but we're having difficulty differentiating between a severe but chronic injury or a chronic active injury. And that's really the degree of activity, you know, amount of fluid accumulation or metabolic activity, like in the PET scan. That's where those things can really come in handy and tell us, okay, this horse has a lesion here, but is it actively causing discomfort and inflammation?
Right. Once you have diagnosed a soft tissue injury, what does your early management strategy look like? And I guess sort of depending on the type of structure that's affected.
Yeah, for horses with acute injuries, in which I've identified them in that early phase of healing, so that inflammatory phase, the first thing that I'm focusing on is decreasing inflammation, decreasing load on the tendon or the ligament, and then decreasing pain. This is really where things like ice or cryotherapy come in. So that's something that I'll absolutely employ during that first phase. And by decreasing that inflammation, you know, the hope is that we're slowing the rate of release of all those inflammatory proteins that are activating enzymes that break down extracellular matrix. So we're trying to decrease that persistent damage that's going on. And that's also where, for me, the judicious use of anti-inflammatory medications come in. So some sort of pain medication. EDS are really the first line of defense for us typically. So, you know, phenylbutazone or Flunix and Meglumine. I personally use phenylbutazone more. You can also consider using furacoxib for horses with, you know, kidney or GI concerns. I've used acetaminophen in some of these cases where we have real concerns that even furacoxib is something that we don't want to use. I don't typically keep horses like this, again, depending very much on the degree of severity of injury, long past the acute, on those pain medications, long past that acute phase of healing. So that first kind of week or so time frame, once they're, you know, comfortable in the stall and at the walk, because really I don't want to be masking pain and I want the horse to be careful with itself. And sometimes right. If you mask pain, they can do sillier things. And this definitely also involves, like I said, decreasing load on the tendon. So, you know, rest and controlled exercise. And that does depend a lot on not only the degree of severity of pain and injury, but also the structure injured. This is probably really where a lot of the differences lie in terms of how we manage these horses. And there's a lot of specifics that we could get into, but what I would say, generally speaking, is that suspensory ligament injuries, for whatever reason, seem to do better with more exercise. And so I tend to be, while typically my controlled exercise and rest regimen involves some combination of stall rest and hand walking to begin with, I may be a little bit more willing to allow more movement in a horse with suspensory disease. So earlier, longer periods of hand walking, or even really some small amounts of turnout, provided that the horse is comfortable and unlikely to do something silly in the field, right, compared to something like a deep digital flexor tendon lesion, for instance.
How have some of the regenerative therapies that are available impacted some of our treatment protocols and outcomes?
Yeah, hugely. Regenerative therapies have absolutely improved outcomes for horses with tendon and ligament injuries. And part of the issue, as we previously discussed with tendon and ligament injuries, is that the type of tissue that they repair with is just inferior from a functional standpoint, and they are very prone to re-injury compared to something like a fracture, where if there's an uncomplicated fracture, bone is going to heal with a similar degree of strength as it had previously. You don't hear of people breaking their arm and then breaking their arm in the same location again, provided that the bone healed normally. But people and horses with, you know, tendon and ligament injuries are absolutely almost always predisposed to injuring that area again. And we now have a really large base of literature supporting the use of intralesional injections with regenerative therapies. There's lots of them, but I would say probably the majority of literature is focused on stem cells of various kinds, and probably the best evidence behind autologous mesenchymal stem cells, and then platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, injected intralesionally into those soft tissues, improving actually the quality of the repair tissue and decreasing re-injury rates, which from an outcome perspective is really massive in terms of making a difference for these horses.
Are you reaching for those therapies in most cases that you're managing?
Yes, absolutely. It definitely depends on how the lesion has to be large, ideally is large enough to where something can be injected intralesionally. I don't like forcing a substance into a small hole, but it doesn't have to be very big. As long as you can get a needle into it, then for me, it's relatively suitable for injection. And the discussion between platelet-rich plasma and stem cells of any variety has to do a lot with finances and availability. And also in some ways, you know, if you're using something autologous, so from your own horse, it depends a little bit on whether the person is able to come back, because you're going to have to get bone marrow and culture it for the stem cells. And so it's not really a point of care treatment in that way. There are stem cells that you can get from other sources that can be a little bit more point of care. For that reason, I often use PRP because it's something that I can use stall side on the same day. But to that note, a lot of people will start with PRP and then follow and then take blood or take bone marrow for stem cell culturing, and then bring the horse back and follow up with mesenchymal stem cells, because we have pretty good evidence to support the use of stem cells in addition to PRP. But stem cells do seem to have some benefits over a lot of the other orthobiologic therapies.
Okay. What are some other research-backed therapies or rehab modalities that you find effective for some of these injuries?
There are a lot of rehabilitation modalities out there. And I will say, I'll just give a plug for, I think that controlled exercise and cryotherapy are, in the acute phases especially, are some of the most important therapies out there that are available. But that said, there is some good literature to support the use of some of the electromodalities in assisting, again, kind of that quality of repair tissue and healing soft tissue injuries. I probably use shockwaves the most. That's something for those of you out there who aren't familiar with shockwave. It's something that produces a high pressure and velocity acoustic wave, and it helps with soft tissue injuries in a couple ways. One is that it kind of creates this little mechanical micro trauma that initiates a healing response, and that's going to improve neovascularization, so the genesis of new blood vessels coming to the area to promote healing. It also produces cavitation. That's the formation and collapse of little bubbles. These release free radicals and create these chemical reactions that also initiate healing. And it also has pain-relieving effects, actually. And we don't know exactly how this works, but probably it actually directly damages some of the pain fibers that then decrease their signaling. And that's probably why it's so helpful from a pain perspective. And we have pretty good information that these are helpful from an evidence base. So especially in superficial digital flexor tendonitis and suspensory desmitis. So, you know, faster resolution of lameness for horses with suspensory ligament desmitis, faster filling of defects in treated limbs compared to untreated limbs, And then in superficial digital flexor tendonitis, there's actual histologic evidence of increased neovascularization as well. I find shockwave to be really helpful in my case population. I especially like to use it in those bone ligament interfaces. So proximal suspensory ligament, you know, suspensory branches. And the nice thing about this from a field perspective is that it is a treatment that you can use that just has to be used 3 times. And I usually do it, you know, sometime between 3 and 4 weeks apart. So it's not something that necessarily you have to do every single day. Class 4 laser therapy is definitely something also that we have some good evidence behind. There's some recent information on experimentally induced suspensory branch tears that with laser therapy compared to a control, so doing nothing, that you'll get smaller lesion sizes on ultrasound, increased Doppler signal, so again, improving vascularity in that area, even smaller lesion sizes on MRI. So I think there's also some good evidence for use, especially coming up and kind of coming into the literature for class 4 laser. I think it's a little bit more questionable for the less powerful lasers. And interestingly, there's some good information that you can use actually these modalities in combination with intralesional therapies like PRP. So I think we are finding that we don't have to be super concerned about the combination of these two things in terms of affecting the clinical efficacy of one of them.
Yeah, that's great. What role does ferriery play in managing these injuries?
It plays a really big role, a really, really big role, mostly because you can alter the biomechanics of the foot to decrease strain on certain tendons and ligaments, particularly those in the palmar aspect and in the plantar aspect of the limb. And the way I like to explain this is that in that back part of the cannon bone in those flexor tendons and ligaments, the deep digital flexor tendon and the inferior check ligament kind of work as a pair, and the suspensory ligament and the superficial digital flexor tendon work as a pair. And you can decrease and increase strain on these pairs of tendons and ligaments depending on how you alter the angle of the coffin bone with respect to the ground. So basically wedging the heel or sinking the heel into the ground. So by increasing the angle of the coffin bone, you decrease tension on the deep digital flexor tendon and on the inferior check ligament. And then you're going to increase tension on the superficial digital flexor tendon and the suspensory ligament. So if you have an injury to the deep digital flexor tendon, that's why we often will recommend something like a wedge shoe that is going to decrease tension on that area. And that often improves pain, and we're trying to kind of facilitate healing in that way. But you do have to be aware that you're going to increase tension on those other structures as well. So maybe not the best thing if the horse has an additional injury to one of those. And alternatively, the opposite is true, right? So if you are trying to lower the heel, then you're going to increase tension on the deep and the check. You're going to decrease tension on the suspensory and the superficial. This is a little harder to accomplish because the ground is just kind of like a natural limit to how low the heel can go. But the shoes that are made that try to encourage sinking of the heels typically have a wider toe and then a narrower bar so that really the heel sinks into the ground, especially in soft footing. And I mean, I find collaborating with farriers really rewarding. I've been really lucky to work with some excellent and very accomplished farriers at New Bolton who've taught me a lot. And I think that it is important to know that there are some kind of best practices for communicating with farriers and working with them. The number one thing to me is just providing a diagnosis. You know, saying that the horse should be better balanced or better shod is not very helpful. And also really talking about the biomechanical principles that you want to accomplish instead of prescribing a certain shoe, I think can be really beneficial. The fact is that really the farrier, especially if they've been working with the horse for a long time, is probably going to have a better understanding of what shoe the horse may or may not do well in more than I am. And so, for instance, there might be a reason that the farrier, you know, doesn't want to put the horse in a bar shoe. Maybe the horse has trouble keeping shoes on, generally speaking. And so a bar shoe really isn't going to be accomplished very easily in this horse. But by saying something like, you know, I want to increase the angle of the sole, I want to, you know, have the horse have a higher heel, then the farrier can think about, okay, is a bar shoe going to be better? Is a wedge going to be better for this specific situation? And I find that to be to facilitate much better collaboration conversation than making a prescription. Because like I said, they have a much different skill set, you know, than we have. And personally, I think providing radiographs is really helpful too. You know, none of us have x-ray eyes. None of us can see what the coffin bone looks like within the hoof wall. And sometimes it can be misleading. And so providing what I kind of, what often people call farrier films. So, you know, a lateral to medial and a dorsal to palmar view, just to give the farrier some internal information and then make adjustments based on those radiographs. And even if you're there, you know, maybe taking some radiographs after shoeing to kind of give them some sense for what their changes made to the actual internal conformation of the foot, I often find really helpful.
Where does the current thinking stand around SARAS versus controlled exercise for these horses?
I mean, this depends a lot on the degree of injury, the chronicity, and the structure that's affected. But generally speaking, for most injuries, I think we're finding that there are definitely some downsides to strict stall rest. And when I say stall rest, I mean, you know, stall rest without any additional hand walking. And often I talk to clients about this as a bit of a tightrope walk. So in order to heal properly, the tendon or ligament really needs to experience some of the normal strains and loads that it's typically undergoing for exercise. That promotes healing of the tendon fibrils in the correct kind of long linear orientation longitudinally to those lines of strain. And if the tendon doesn't experience these strains, they often will heal in a more haphazard fashion, which from a functional perspective is going to be inferior. That said, we don't want the horse to place so much strain on the tendon or the ligament that it overwhelms the strength of those newly healing fibrils and then results in re-injury. And in horses, this is a really tough balance because they don't know what we're asking of them. And so they can't protect themselves as well as we would like them to. But because of that, I often start with stall rest, but with progressive hand walking. So for me, that kind of toes the balance between those two things. It allows the soft tissues to experience some load in a controlled fashion, but decreases the risk of unintended episodes of higher loads that can happen in the field. So if the horse, you know, decides to get excited and gallop around. And there really isn't a prescription for this type of controlled exercise. It definitely varies from horse to horse. But generally speaking, it involves, you know, stall rest and progressive hand walking for 2 to 3 months, stall rest and progressive walking plus progressive trotting for 2 to 3 months, and then incorporating some canter work. And if the horse, for me, is holding up to canter work and everything is looking good on our reevaluations, then I usually feel comfortable starting with short periods of turnout, because at that point, we know that those healing soft tissues are able to withstand higher loads. And so we're probably less likely to re-injure during those kind of unanticipated high speeds in the field. And kind of along those lines, it really depends on the horse's personality too. A horse that is older and more quiet and doesn't tend to run around the field to begin with, I might be a little bit more interested in allowing those horses some round pen turnout or a little small paddock turnout. But horses with more severe injuries and those that are younger can be more excitable. Oftentimes, I am trying to keep in the stall. Now, that said, there are naturally just going to be limitations for what people can accomplish and what they have available. And so there is a gold standard, but generally speaking, I think we have to be able to, you know, work with our clients with what they have available. Some horses are just not amenable to stall rest, period. And so in those situations, small round pen with the addition of some chemical assistance, so something like, you know, trazodone to try to facilitate mostly walking, I think can be really beneficial.
Yeah, I imagine if a horse stall walks or weaves, that might be a little bit more detrimental than maybe some small turnout.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I guess also with the young sport horses, often hand walking can be a little bit exciting sometimes too. So maybe yes, you're reaching for drugs in those cases.
Yeah. Yeah. I personally have found trazodone to be really helpful. I think it's relatively well tolerated. It has a pretty high safety margin. And you can vary the dosage pretty substantially. So and absolutely, I found that helpful. But in reality, sometimes slow controlled hand walking is just not very feasible.
How do you assess healing and monitor progress during the rehabilitation progress? And how often do you want to see these horses following the initial diagnosis?
Yeah, there are three major kind of categories of things that I'm looking for when I'm monitoring progress. The first is the physical exam parameters. So if it's in an area that I can palpate, I'm looking for improvements in size, swelling, and pain on palpation. The lameness evaluation is key. So I want to see improvement in degree of lameness. And ideally, I look at them in straight lines and circles. Lameness is often exacerbated in circles. And so evaluating them under the circumstances that you evaluated them initially is really helpful. And oftentimes I incorporate imaging as well. This is typically for me ultrasound if it's in an area that we can identify. Whether or not an MRI is necessary in terms of, you know, repeating general anesthesia and cost, I think has to be a conversation with the owner. But quite honestly, many times repeat assessment from an MRI or PET scan perspective is sometimes recommended as well. You know, in terms of repeat evaluation intervals, I typically reevaluate horses around 10 weeks. So I kind of say generally speaking in the 2 to 3 month category. If horses are severely injured, I typically do want to look at them a bit sooner. So maybe in a month to make sure that things are progressing in the right direction, at least from a physical exam and lameness perspective. That said, it generally takes about 8 to 10 weeks to see substantial enough changes on ultrasound to know which direction we're progressing. And so that to me is why that interval works. And this time frame actually works out well for me as well, because it's right around when horses are about to change what or progress to a different gait. So from walk to trot or trot to canter, or maybe canter to something more advanced. And I do like to see horses and reassess them to make sure that everything is static to improved from an imaging perspective and improved, or, you know, sound from a lameness perspective, to feel comfortable that the horse is able to withstand higher loads. Every once in a while with an owner or a trainer that I really trust, I'll actually have them start incorporating a little bit of that higher speed, maybe a week or two before I assess them. I think that that's reasonable as well, but you do want to make sure that it's, you know, somebody whose assessment you trust, so that you're not going to be taking a couple steps back during that higher speed time.
Yeah, that's a great point. After you've gone through the treatment rehabilitation program, how do you advise owners regarding their long-term performance, risk of re-injury, and ongoing management? Because obviously these horses are always going to be a little bit more predisposed to future injury. So what does that look like?
Yeah. Again, very dependent on the degree of injury and location. You know, dealing with something like a check ligament desmitis, where horses, at least for me, tend to do relatively well compared to, say, you know, a horse with a deep digital flexor tendon tear in the navicular region, where the prognosis for those horses tends to be more guarded. Like you said, generally speaking, though, the risk of re-injury is definitely going to be higher for tendon ligament injuries. And it's for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, the turnover rate for collagen in those tissues is just kind of low. So it's just not replaced very often. And then again, that, you know, the type of collagen that is used in repair, so type 3 collagen, is stiffer and less elastic. So again, prone to re-injury. And the presence of tendon sheaths, so injuries that are within tendon sheaths, do tend to do more poorly. Partly because actually the tendon in those areas don't have a peritenon, or kind of an encasing around them. And that peritenon is usually the structure that provide blood and fibroblasts for healing. And when that tendon is damaged and exposed to synovial fluid, that exposure can also actually result in exacerbation of injury. So for all of those reasons, as you said, these horses are definitely prone to re-injury. And quite honestly, for horses with previous injuries in certain areas and of certain degrees, you know, significant proximal suspensory desmitis, you know, similarly deep digital flexor tendonitis, again, depending a little bit on the management strategy, we may just need to have an honest conversation with the owner that returning to the same degree of activity or level of activity might result in re-injury, and that lower levels of work might be ideal to maintain longevity of athleticism. I think sometimes that just does happen. And also, I think making owners in terms of, you know, risk assessment, I think, or managing risk of re-injury, all of those things that we talked about before in terms of, you know, altering the type of training that they're doing and limiting high speeds as much as they can while keeping the horse fit and limiting over fences work, you know, as much as they can while also making sure that they're prepared for competition and, you know, making sure their foot conformation is suitable and they don't have Cushing's disease. I think outside of that, just making owners aware that subtle changes in performance might be indicative of a deterioration in the tendon can be really helpful, and also kind of training them to be able to identify increased swelling or enlargement of the tendon, you know, teaching them how to palpate their horses so that they can really catch any of those subtle injuries can be really helpful, because if you catch them early, it is much more likely that you're going to be able to get that horse back into work and healed. So again, very dependent on the degree of injury, but I think teaching your clients how to identify an exacerbation and injury can be really helpful in risk in trying to decrease the risk of those re-injuries, or at least the more substantial ones.
Do you find that re-injuries can heal as effectively the second time or even the third time, or is it more of like a downward spiral?
I think it's more of a downward spiral. I think, you know, re-injuries are certainly going to decrease the functional, you know, a larger area of disease, decreased function of the types of healing tissue that are in there. I think personally that re-injuries tend to be much harder to manage than that initial injury. We have a lot of ways in which to manage these horses now, which is why I say, like, depending on the management type, because, you know, deep digital flexor tendon tears, we now have surgical interventions for these horses like tenoscopy or navicular bursoscopy, which, you know, we certainly find can improve their outcomes. And even in some cases, things like, you know, deep lateral plantar neurectomies and fasciotomies, where we can kind of get these horses back to some type of work, again, depending a little bit on the type of competition that you're trying to pursue. But I think we are getting better and better, I guess, is how I would say it, at being able to manage these horses.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Brown, for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I would like to say thank you again to Dr. Brown for joining us, and thank you to Equithrive for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our audience for listening to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please email me at csisson@equinenetwork.com.